Hello and welcome back to this week's What Just Happened with myself, Will Marshall, and my good friend Alistair Simmons. Welcome back. We've had a week off. We had a break after like 6 months of writing a reasonably long newsletter every week and a good few weeks of the podcast, and we've come back refreshed and energized. So as usual, we'll be taking a little wander through some of the most interesting news articles we've read this week, and you can get in touch with us at WJH Blog on Facebook and Twitter, and shout at us or give us feedback or whatever you choose to do. So Ali, should we start with the good news?
Yeah, let's start with the good news.
Good news.
I was just going to start with the Drake equation. I don't think I've heard of this before.
The Drake equation, yeah. It's quite interesting. So this is a way to ascertain the lower limit of the likely number of planets with intelligent life capable of establishing communications with us. And basically some work's been done over the last few months on taking into account some more things that we know about the galaxy that we didn't the last time this was sort of recalculated a few years ago, and they've come to a new figure for the number of civilizations that they think we could get in contact with, which is 36, which is a very pleasant number. It's one of my favorite numbers, actually. It can be divisible so many ways. Anyway, so that's 36 possible civilizations within our galaxy. Now it's very unlikely that we'd actually managed to contact any of these assay people, green men, because the distances involved, so the closest one is I think something like 7,000 light years away. So you'd need another 7,000 years for the sound to get there and back. I haven't explained that very well at all. Read the article, there's a link, it's great.
So if you're traveling at the speed of light, it'll take you 6,120 years to get to the nearest of these.
Yes, that is a much better explanation.
36 is remarkably close to 42, isn't it?
That's what I was thinking, yeah.
It's almost a Douglas Adams reference.
Gave me a little shiver, that. Made me very happy. I think Douglas Adams would be pleased. If only we knew.
It kind of gets you around the Fermi paradox, doesn't it? The Fermi paradox, if I'm remembering correctly, is one of those many things in popular culture which is called a paradox, despite not being in any way, shape, or form paradoxical. Just like, oh, why haven't the aliens come and contacted us yet? Because the universe is big. The universe is really, really big.
Less of a paradox, more just a fact.
It's like the simulation paradox, isn't it? It's like, oh, we must be living in a simulation. It's like, well, yes, if you start off with the premise that we're in a simulation, then we must be in a simulation. Otherwise, it's not very confusing. No. Anyway, enough of my philosophical pretense, as usual.
Like, go and argue with Elon.
I'm gonna segue us on a completely irrelevant tangent onto the story about Chaz. Swing low, sweet Chaziot, or Chaziots of fire, whatever you prefer. Quite proud of both of those.
You're working on those.
Quite
ones.
Funny.
Yeah, good puns.
It's been a long 2 weeks. All I've been doing. I don't have anything else going on. The Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. Sorry, did you have anything else you wanted to say about the aliens?
No, I'm done on the aliens. I mean, not permanently.
Aliens and Anarchists, that's the new title of the blog. The Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone has reached a slightly unglorious end after a spate of shootings. This is why America can't have nice things. It's why I can't have nice anarcho-syndicalist communes, because they always end in senseless gun violence.
So just for context, this was the area of Seattle which had been occupied by the protesters, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And it's in Capitol Hill, which is kind of like Seattle's Shoreditch. It's pretty trendy, up and coming, with a big street festival there every summer.
A lot of beards, lots of coffee.
Too much coffee. There's a couple of videos of the self-appointed leader of this, which I'll get to how ridiculous that is in a second, but there's a couple of videos of him stood on the roof of a car talking in front of a Starbucks, and it's like the Starbucks logo is like obsequiously, it's sort of very obviously in the background. It's just like, we're in Seattle. Like, is Starbucks, are you willingly giving Starbucks this material? Like,
it's just impossible to be that far away from a Starbucks in Seattle.
So it's pretty interesting experiment. People are fed up of getting tear gassed by the police. The police have been pretty aggressive, and the protesters effectively took hold of a kind of 4 to 6 block area of this pretty gentrified area of Seattle. And it was the boogeyman for the conservatives. Like, they were just like, ah, Antifa have finally got their first territory, the organization that is. Which, obviously, it's not an organization. And I'm getting on a side rant here. The coverage of this stuff is so annoying. Like, you'll read in a major news outlet something like, this is, the conservatives are scared that this is Antifa's first territory. Although Antifa is a decentralized organization, a spokesperson representing it. How is it being represented by the, you've just contradicted yourself in like 2 lines. It's not even readable. It's just nonsense. Anyhow, some chap kind of appointed himself as the leader of this group. Cynically, I think he's just promoting his hip hop label. I have a few friends who ended up, had a reasonable amount of first-hand accounts of what it's like over there, and apparently he's not very popular. He's generally considered a bit of an asshole. And, you know, it's like, what kind of person stands up and says, I'm the leader of this anarchist group? Like, we're all united in our rejection of hierarchy, and I'm the leader.
I rejected the most.
Yeah, right? It's bullshit. So there's a couple of videos of him on his Twitter, among other things, using a flamethrower in the street to try and burn a green tree. It's quite weird. And he's positioning himself as a, not to call nonsense or, you know, be unnecessarily critical, but he's kind of positioning himself as an organizer and a political activist. But everything on his Twitter feed before the protests became very popular was just his hip-hop career. I didn't see anything about political activism. So, unsurprisingly, he's not super popular. Probably did quite a lot more to damage the movement than he did help it, in a kind of Tim O'Leary type way. And the mayor of Seattle is fed up with the shooting. Also, local businesses are suing the city over the handling of chaos, which is quite interesting. Mm. And maybe a little bit, well, you know, kind of screwy on many levels, but... I think it might suggest that the businesses would have been doing fine otherwise, which is obviously nonsense. Like, remember that pandemic that's still going on? We weren't all distracted for a few weeks. That hasn't gone away. Like, everyone seems much less cognizant of that now that there are 2 million cases of it in the States rather than like 1,000. It's like, great. I'm getting old. And it's like, anyway, what's the takeaway from that, Will?
Well, I think the takeaway is that anarchists need a leader. They need a strong leader like Raz. That's important. I don't know. I'm not sure what the takeaway is. I think the takeaway is that the Americans can't have nice things. I think you said it. You said it best. And also guns. Yeah,
I mean, it's
not great.
You know what I think of when I see this chance thing. I think of communes that exist in the gaps between the west and east side of the Berlin Wall. Those things are insane. They've been there for decades. People are predominantly peaceful. It's just like long-standing anarcho-syndicalist squat things that are they're still there. I remember walking past them on a school trip with an incredibly nervous teacher years and years ago, which was absolutely hilarious. But, like, you know, like what can happen in Germany after the fall of the Berlin Wall and reunification and all that is quite different to what can happen in a gentrified area of Seattle.
But Christiania as well in Copenhagen,
right.
An interesting one. I mean, we had a very memorable evening there. Well, I say memorable when we were about 18, and I think the thing that made me laugh the most about that entire thing was being in this sort of anarchist, leaderless commune society where people seemed to be pretty happy. And then there were two things that really stood out, and one was a conversation with somebody in which she said, yeah, it's pretty cool, it's usually pretty chilled apart from occasionally when the police come and we throw Molotov cocktails at them, which made things feel a lot less chilled. And then there was also about, I don't know, 2 or 3 a.m. when I saw a Coca-Cola van arrived to restock one of the restaurants. And that juxtaposition just really, it was really, really jarring and really made me realize what this, you know, what the limits are to a commune existing in the developed modern cities that we have. It's yeah, funny place.
That's fascinating. You can reject the government, reject its institutions, but can you actually reject the supply chains and the market forces? Like, what's the predominant? Where's the power coming from? God, that's thought provoking. Should we talk about the man who tried to ensure pandemics?
Yes, yes. Let's talk about Nathan Wolfe. This is really interesting, and we've linked to the full article in Wired from this month's edition, and it is well worth reading. It's a longer one, and it goes into much greater detail than we do. But it's about a virologist, Nathan Wolfe, and he became convinced, as so many others did, during his study of cross species virus transmission, that we were due a pretty big pandemic on a large scale. He said in 2006, it's about a 100 year event, and the longer he studied this, he realized that one of the biggest human impacts of a disease like this would actually be the effect on the economy, because as much as you know, we support lockdown and everything like that, there's a direct correlation between economic damage and deaths and premature deaths, which is difficult to reconcile. And so he established a company which crunched data on pandemics and actually spun it off into what would become the world's first pandemic insurance. Now, pandemic insurance hasn't really existed. Now, you may have business insurance that you believe covers you for things like pandemics, as I did. And it turns out the business interruption does not cover you for pandemics, for quite a good reason, really, in that insurance works by hedging its bets. So, you know, your local insurance company buys a reinsurance package, which packages together many, many insurances, so that, you know, if you have a colossal storm that floods out the entire area, it would send your local insurance company bankrupt if they didn't have reinsurance against somewhere else that hasn't had a massive storm. So, but what happens when you have a pandemic, when the entire world is affected? It's a very, very difficult to insure. The way that you can do it is to sell them to pension funds, which will buy the reinsurance on pandemics. Anyway, Nathan Wolfe tried to set one of these up. He did set it up in 2018, but nobody bought it. So there'll be quite a few people kicking themselves on that one now. And anyway, yeah, so he's not kicking himself, because obviously it would have put him well out of business, having a pandemic within 2 years of selling said pandemic insurance. But everybody's chomping at the bit to buy it now.
So it sounds ridiculous on the face of it, doesn't it? Pandemic insurance. It sounds like volcano insurance. Or,
exactly.
You know, so it sounds silly. But just to illustrate the point about the local, like, risk locally versus risk globally and isolated events, and assuming they're not all going to happen concurrently, well, you could sensibly sell an insurance against volcano eruptions on the assumption that not everyone... There isn't going to be a critical mass of people all over the globe. If you have this global company, some of your global products, that all are afflicted by volcanoes in some way at the same time. But you might not be able to sell super volcano insurance, because if the super volcano in Yellowstone goes off, it's going to be a global catastrophe, and you will definitely go bankrupt, and you won't be able to pay out a meaningful amount of your claims if shit hits the fan, if magma hits the fan. And the thing about the pension funds is quite interesting. Just see if I'm understanding this right. Pension funds are going to have to pay out pensions in the future, and they're going to have to pay out more money the longer people live. And if there's a pandemic and loads of people die, they get to pay out less money.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to remember this incentive. Are they in some way, shape, or form hedging their bets buying this
yeah,
pandemic
basically.
Insurance?
I need to look into this, exactly why, what the motivation was.
What was the logic there?
Yeah. Anyway, pension funds were buying it. Pension funds offered to back the reinsurance policy for pandemics. So clearly there's a reason. We'll find out.
So that's it. They weren't buying it. They were underwriting it.
Underwriting it, yeah.
Are you going to buy a pandemic insurance? Well,
yeah, definitely. Would have bought it. No, there's no. But this is the funny thing, is obviously all of these companies now are buying this pandemic insurance, And, you know, the chances of another major pandemic coming around in the next sort of 25 years are pretty slim. So you can see exactly what's going to happen there. Everybody thinks, oh, yeah, we'll buy pandemic insurance. And then in 10 years' time, there'll be a different sea level. And they'll be going, what the hell are we spending all this money for on pandemic insurance? We're wasting all this money. So they'll stop paying the premiums and they'll no longer have pandemic insurance. And that's how the insurance industry wins.
Happy birthday to Anne. Happy birthday to Anne. Happy birthday, United Nations. Happy birthday to Anne. That's about the level of enthusiasm that everyone's got for it, isn't it? The United Nations are going to turn 75 soon. And I saw a pretty interesting stat recently that apparently a lot of people have more faith in the United Nations than they do in their own governments.
Well, I can believe that. Just certainly in the UK.
Yeah, right. Bloody hell. And something, although this is a weird piece of research, it's from, God, what was that name? It's from a big PR firm in the States, and this was referenced in The Economist. They basically just surveyed people, like, you know, a few hundred people in 32 countries. It's like, okay, cool, a few hundred people are presumably representative of millions of residents. Like, likely story. But nevertheless, it's kind of a feasible idea that the UN would be more popular than local governments. And I think a lot of the events of the 21st century, of 2020 so far, like almost going to war with Iran, global pandemic, nuclear non-proliferation still a thing, climate change is still a thing, tax dodging billionaires are still a thing. These are all things which a global set of institutions would be great at tackling in an ideal world.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. I read somewhere, I think it was in The Economist this week, that the UN's peacekeeping forces, which protect around, or try to protect around 250 million people around the world, have pretty much the same budget as the New York Police Department. So, as a way to spend cash, that's pretty effective.
Wow, that's crazy.
Right.
I'm trying to remember if we've spoken about Linda Pullman's "We Did Nothing" in this blog in the past 6 months. That's a completely amazing book. It basically drives home the point that the UN isn't really more than its constituent members. And in order to make this point, it takes you on a tour of their greatest disasters in the 90s, really. And, okay, the peacekeeping forces can't intervene if the local authorities aren't basically asking them to, than some other official channel. And it's like this initiation of not, they can't be the first people to intervene. They have to actually be fired upon if they're going to do anything. So they end up like just standing in the sidelines watching genocides happen and all kinds of gnarly shit. I'd always taken this for the past few years, a bit more discrediting of the UN as an institution than I think is probably fair, given that I only recently learned that peacekeeping wasn't actually in the initial charter. It wasn't one of the initial hopes of the project. So it's something which they, which was kind of innovated into later in the project. And I think that gives grounds for cautious optimism about what it might be able to do if it keeps chugging over, moving into the future. And how will, if the UN generally has represented the world a few decades ago, where you've got the kind of powers that be at the end of the Second World War as having permanent seats in the Security Council, what might it look like moving forward?
Well, this is the issue, isn't it? It's how the UN actually reforms itself, because the current situation with the Permanent Security Council is bizarre, and it's not representative of the world today. You know, why have the English got a seat on the Security Council, but China don't, Japan don't? It doesn't really make any sense. It doesn't accurately represent the balance of power. Why do we need a permanent Security Council of 7 members anyway? It's you know, these things need to be debated. But by the very way that the Security Council has been formed, it would be very difficult to change it. So I don't know. It's kind of like the EU argument, isn't it? The EU isn't perfect. It's certainly not worth abandoning it. And I think the UN's the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely. The 5 permanent members of the Security Council China, France, Russia, the UK, and the US. I don't know when China joined. And then there's 10 non-permanent members elected on 4 two-year terms by the General Assembly. And the a lot of the quality of the discussion and the conversations is kind of driven by the permanent members,
yeah,
which is quite interesting. And then obviously the US and the UK are happy to do stuff like go into illegal wars in the Middle East with complete unequivocal condemnation from the rest of the Security Council. So it's like, okay, cool, what was the point in this again? but it's definitely, you know, at a time where the US is defunding the World Health Organization and you're having G7 international incidents because the members can't actually put out a statement about the US behavior because Pompeo is insisting that they call the coronavirus the Wuhan virus, and the G7 is like, no, we're not doing that, it's ridiculous. So they actually struggle to formally communicate the US's status on something. The need for a common place to have these discussions seems super prevalent. Yeah. It seems really important. I'm going to get a UN t-shirt.
What do you mean, Anne? So, wet markets? Have you ever been to a wet market?
Yeah, I bought a big old finger salmon at a wet market in Brixton.
Oh,
after wow. Last time I was in London. And I'm remembering... I learned what a wet market is from reading this bit of research.
Right. Well, this is so a wet market is a term that's been coming around quite a bit recently because it's believed that the coronavirus pandemic started in a wet market in Wuhan called the Huanan Seafood Wholesale Market, I think. And the issue with wet markets is that they don't just do trade in dead meat. By the very nature, you know, a lot of the animals that are being sold there are live, and then you've got the wildlife trade interacting with it, and you've got potentially captured live animals that wouldn't usually come into contact with each other, which do.
Right, so that's the unusual thing here, isn't it? It didn't just come from a wet market. It came from a wet market that is in the same building as one that sells live wild animals.
Yes, exactly. And this is where there's a slight issue coming, because the sort of natural reaction from anybody reasonable would, on hearing that the fact that this came out of a wet market, would be, well, we just ban wet markets, don't we? Like, that's what we do. But surely that's the sensible thing to do. But obviously it's a little bit more nuanced than that, you know, as these things always are. The wet markets are all over the world. They're in every major city in the world, and they're culturally important to huge communities of immigrants in the West, and not just, you know, wet markets were where we bought our food from until refrigeration became widespread. Now, I'm not saying they can not be horrifying. I've been in a couple of wet markets in Morocco, and that was pretty gnarly, not gonna lie. Quite a smell that'll stay with me for the rest of my life. But there's something to be said for buying your chicken that fresh if you're gonna eat your chicken. And you know, one of the points that people have made quite rightly is that when you get rid of wet markets, all you're actually doing is putting everything behind closed doors and putting everything in one place and concentrating potentially problematic abattoir conditions in one place from where a load of food is distributed all around an area or a country or internationally, and which can spread disease, as happens, as the US has a massive problem with food poisoning, and as you pointed out, E. coli on lettuce.
Oh Jesus! That's just on the wet market thing. So it comes from, we've got in here that it's the fact that the ice that's used to keep the food fresh melting.
There's quite a few explanations for the name, and one is that ice is usually used to keep it fresh, and they're washed down and slightly more gorily. There tends to be blood around.
But you know, like going to like local smelly fish market and getting a nice big bit of salmon where you can actually see the whole thing and it's sat on a bed of ice, like that's one thing. Seeing a pangolin shuffling around among the training ice cubes would be quite another thing.
That is a different thing, yeah. And that's where regulation comes in. Proper regulation and enforcement. You know, it's all very well to just say, oh, you just shut down all of these wet markets. Well, that doesn't really effectively change anything. You'd still have the wildlife markets. They'd just go underground.
A cautionary tale to the UK as we've moved into Brexit and start trying to get a load of experimental US hormone-fed beef and other things, as we sidestep all of these ridiculous European regulations about how we shouldn't wash our lettuce with poo water.
And, and how we shouldn't have maggots in our peanut butter and rat hair in our jam.
I know it sounds like a complete joke, but people genuinely get E. coli in the States from lettuce. What on earth? That is so unthinkably gnarly.
I'm also fascinated by the fact that you guys spray all of your fruit and veg with water constantly. You just mist it constantly.
Yeah, you get nice, soggy, tasteless herbs.
Nice, nice Legionella sprayed fruit and veg for everybody. Great. I'll have that with my chlorine chicken, thanks. I mean, this is one of the things about lockdown. It's been pretty funny in our family household here that my mother has been spraying absolutely everything that gets delivered with copious amounts of watered down bleach, which I'm pretty sure I've consumed more chlorine washed food than I will do in the next 25 years. Just go in to get a slice of sourdough bread and you're like, Mum, the sourdough smells of pools again. It's quite an experience. We may not get coronavirus, but we may die of bleach poisoning. I think we should go onto the K-hole. This was a short story. It's pretty entertaining. So some researchers at Cambridge University have been working on drug therapies for Huntington's disease, and have inadvertently stumbled on the scientific explanation for the K-hole. Now, if you're not aware of a K-hole is effectively a near brain death experience that recreational users of horse tranquilizer can experience. And basically, they've shown that when they give sheep ketamine at similar levels to humans take recreationally, the sheep's brains switch off for a number of minutes. And when you say switch off, literally, they become temporarily brain dead. That's what happens. And we should read the article if you want a little bit more detail on this, but I can say firsthand, having worked as a fire marshal at Leeds Festival in the UK, which is a gnarly experience, that yes, people do become temporarily brain dead when they take enough ketamine, like setting their own tents on fire and then just sitting in them as they burn around them.
I like your point in here about if aliens visited the Earth. What's your deal? What are you guys up to? Recreational usage of horse tranquilizers.
That's humans.
says a million words, that, doesn't it? But there's an interesting point in Michael Pollan's How to Change Your Mind, where he talks about this emerging science around the default mode network.
Mm.
And it's the portion of your brain which houses the ego. At least that's the theory. It's reasonably new. It's not incredibly well validated, but it sounds like qualitatively kind of a useful idea. So it's stuff like if you're a rock climber or if you do extreme sports and you're doing things which you kind of get into a state of flow in doing, it's quite easy to in those kinds of environments at least. The idea is that your brain is too busy focusing on the other stuff, like the very real and pressing risk of falling to your death, then that it doesn't have the time to invest its energy in the ego and in the stuff in the default mode network. So this idea of like brain activity, and then obviously psychedelics also have lots to do with this, so the idea of brain activity kind of slowing down or otherwise being put into other places means you have less time to be wondering about how you relate to the environment, and you spend more time just being an animal in it. So I think this jives with my understanding of that quite well.
It's interesting as well that there's some major new studies taking place for the first time in sort of 30 or 40 years into the use of MDMA in psychological therapy, and obviously there's a lot of stories of how effective this is, but there's not been any quantitative evidence really because of the ban on using them in clinical studies, and there's a new research center just been set up in I forget which American university, but it could be really transformative into looking into these sorts of measures. Really interesting stuff.
Did you ever read Jurassic Park, Will?
I haven't read it, no.
Oh, it's such a good book.
I must read it.
Michael Crichton, you read James Gleick's Chaos, and that was a lot of what informed his thinking about it. Sensitive dependence on initial conditions and how it relates to genetic code. And yeah, I guess all the dinosaurs were, obviously it's fiction, I have to remind myself, but all the dinosaurs were supposed to be one sex, weren't they? So they weren't going to reproduce and go rogue and overtake the island. and people in Florida are trying to do basically following that plot line with mosquitoes.
Yeah.
Is there some overlap?
Well, this is, so it's actually a British company that is doing this. Interesting that the British company should choose to do it, not in Britain. but yeah, so they are set to release 750 million genetically modified mosquitoes in Florida, which can probably only improve Florida, let's be honest. But the idea is that the mosquitoes carry a gene, a protein that prevents any female offspring from biting and reduce their chances of survival. And they think that basically this can seriously affect the mosquito population and reduce it. The issue is there's been very little oversight into how the trial will take place, and literally no assessment whatsoever done on any possible environmental impacts, which could be negative. So it really is a little bit of a Jurassic Park moment of just releasing millions and millions of genetically modified prehistoric creatures, and let's see what happens.
I think I can see more ways of that going wrong than the liquid gas battery idea as the other big science piece from this week. That sounds quite...
Yeah, this is fascinating. So liquid gas, so the idea, the problem is with renewable energy, basically, that it doesn't always generate energy when you need it, and sometimes it generates energy when you don't need it. And the thing we need to sort out before we can really transform our grids is energy storage. And one of the ways that we've been looking at doing that recently is through compressing air until it's a liquid, storing that up, and then when you need it, you release it, you decompress the air, and turn that back into electric energy. So the biggest one in the world is being built just down the road from me. In fact, a part of it literally went past my house the other day, a colossal tank on about sort of 20 meters high. They had to take all the cables down as it was going. Fascinating to watch. Anyway, so the biggest one in the world is being built, and it's huge. It can power up to 200,000 homes for 5 hours, and it's a really big step in the right direction because it's a hell of a lot cheaper in terms of your capital than building a traditional electric storage battery. And you can build it pretty much everywhere. I mean, everywhere's got air. What can go wrong?
Well, and I mean, there's like a finite supply of the materials that go into building these lithium-ion batteries and other things, right? And, and most of those are
and China's hugely environmentally damaging as well. In the
Often mined by people in pretty gnarly conditions. I need to stop using it. I need a better adjective. And I mean, China invested like $150 billion or something similar in the past decade or so in African infrastructure in exchange for various mineral rights.
Yeah.
So it's probably important that we have local ways of doing large batteries. And while the Electric Mountain in Wales is a fantastic instantiation of like an upscale version of this, you need a mountain and two lakes at different heights so you can pump water between them.
It's also, you know, it doesn't do, in terms of the actual storage of energy, it doesn't come even close. I mean, you know, from Electric Mountain, you're talking about maybe like a 20-minute boost to the national grid, but the longevity is not huge. And I think in terms of efficiency, compressed air is considerably higher. I mean, that's always the issue with electric storage, is you lose a big chunk of it in changing form of power. But yeah, interesting stuff.
William Barr and his... concerted effort to undermine the American rule of law has the really weird thing about this is after William Barr and the Department of Justice did something which everyone's described as unprecedented, highly unusual, deciding to not pursue a case after the defendant has pleaded guilty multiple times for lying to the FBI, you know, not a small crime, this ended up going to a court of appeal. And the judges on that court of appeal are appointed by political parties for some reason. And it was there were three judges on it, two of whom were Republicans, and two of whom voted to drop the charges against Flynn. So the idea that there hasn't been any political intervention in this whole thing is a complete fiction. And you've got Barr getting an interview, kind of preempting a bunch of people from the Department of Justice whistleblowing that there's been interference right from the top, and there's been a series of cases like this as well. Roger Stone, who should have got a much harsher sentence than he ended up with in accordance with federal guidelines and all this other stuff. But yeah, there's this quote from from the NPR coverage of this. Attorney General William Barr said Thursday that he doesn't believe President Trump has overstepped the boundaries between the White House and the Justice Department in a number of big recent cases. If that needs saying, then you're in serious trouble, right? Like, what? It's absolutely absurd that needs saying. So yeah, spooky. Again, unsurprising that people have more faith in the UN.
So this is a plain farcical story, but so you may have noticed, if you're in the UK or indeed not in the UK, we're not doing that great at the moment. Between the fact that the health and the economy has been totally ravaged by a pandemic, and we're entirely split as a country over our racist past, and we're about to have a cliff edge Brexit no deal. And we have lost confidence completely in our government, as statistics show. We really don't believe in them anymore. So we've done the only logical thing, which is repaint a plane. So we have an aircraft, an RAF aircraft, which Boris Johnson and senior members of the royal family have access to, and it's quite a sensible idea because we share the aircraft with the RAF, which means when it's not being used by VIPs, then it's used as a multi-role military aircraft. So it can be used to transport troops, it can be used as an air tanker and do air-to-air refueling, or you can stick the VIP seats in and you can fly it to a world summit. Now, the drawback of this is that it is painted in a quite drab RAF grey. Now, Boris doesn't like that. He's been complaining about it for some time that he doesn't like the colour. So he's spent £900,000 on having it painted into the Brexit plane, which he feels better represents us as a country as we move forward. So it's basically just looks exactly like a British Airways flight now. It's got a giant garish UK flag, a Union flag on the tail. It's got a big gold United Kingdom and billboard writing along the side. Real classy stuff. And
I'm glad it hasn't ended up as just the big red torpedo type thing that it was looking like in some mock-ups, like just like the Brexit bus, like $500 million to a month to the NHS, a week to the NHS, but if it were a plane.
One of my favourite things about this entire thing is the argument about the union flag and whether it's the right way up, because it's painted on the tail, right? Which means, now what they've done is quite cleverly, really, is they've painted it so that if you look at it from the right-hand side, with the front of the tail being the flagpole, then the flag's the right way. But that means, because they've done a mirror image on the other side, that the flag is then the wrong way when you look from the other side. So it's the one thing that's united us as a nation is arguing over whether the Union Jack is in fact the right way up on our stupid, stupid plane.
And it's now a considerably more conspicuous colour than the kind of...
Well, it's not going to be much use in any sort of a military role, is it? Because it's bright, bloody, red, white and blue. Oh, yes, don't mind us, we're just here to invade.
Those air-to-air refueling things are pretty... Those are quite sci-fi, aren't they?
The air tankers.
Yeah, it's amazing that a jet can refuel from another jet without landing. It's an incredible piece of engineering, that.
It's astonishing, yeah. And the first completely autonomous one has just been tested by Airbus, actually, for the first time. So there's no need for an operator, a boom operator in the tanker plane. The thing can just find its way to the jet that it's refueling. Absolutely amazing.
I don't have anything else I want to talk about.
I think we should wrap it up there.
Right, thanks for your time, Will. That was great fun. As always, if anyone has any thoughts on anything that we've spoken about, if you want to hear more about anything, if you want us to dig a little bit deeper into any of these stories, or start hassling anyone from any of the companies that we've mentioned or any of the initiatives that we've spoken about, we're always happy to send out a few emails, as ourselves or as other people. You can participate in the conversation on Twitter at WJHblog, or go to whatjusthappened.news, and you'll see all of our blogs from the past 6 months, and there's a newsletter where we send out this text as well. So thank you for listening.